Senator Javits, distinguished guests on the dais, members of the Sales Club, International Club, guests. My wife, Pat, and I are extremely pleased to be here, and I say that for three reasons. First, of course, to receive with deep gratitude and humility this very distinguished award and to join the list of previous recipients. I guess I've been in public service long enough to know that the recognition given to me here today is in reality a recognition of public service in general and a reward for the countless faceless public officials who work for the American people and the American good day to day. And in that context, I accept it with gratitude and appropriate humility. Incidentally, I think I would like to just comment in reflection on yesterday. Not because we've seen a world leader pass the scene, not because we had a satellite put into orbit successfully, but more importantly, because this was a day set aside at long last to recognize our Vietnam veterans and to relegate to them the distinction so importantly earned, which has always gone to America's veterans. Now, secondly, I'm delighted to be here because I'm just delighted to be anywhere these days, especially after my recent experiences in Washington. You know, a few weeks ago, I joined that great television person, Barbara Wawa. And she said to me, "Oh, General, how does it feel to have been suddenly moved from fourth in line to presidential succession to a position where you have to scramble for a place in the supermarket checkout line?" I said, "Barbara, it's pure hell." In fact, I was having such withdrawal pains, I called my old friend Ed Muskie and asked him if he had a similar experience. Ed said, "Don't worry, Al, it's a matter of a few hours, it passes." Still having a gnawing feeling in my stomach, I called Cy Vance. Cy gave me much the same report as did Ed. But still being uncertain, I turned to my dear old friend, Henry Kissinger. He said, "I know exactly how you feel." He said, "I've gone through cycles of depression that have been the most anguishing of my life." I said, "Henry, how long did the last cycle continue?" He said, "From the moment you entered my office and sat in my chair." But I want you to know the pressures continued. Just the other day, the chairman of the new independent satellite corporation in Texas that just launched the first private sector satellite successfully called Pat and said, "We'd like to rename the satellite, change the name from Constellation 1 to Hague 1. My wife said, "Why do you want to do a thing like that?" They said, "It's simple. It quit twice and blew up once before it went into orbit." Now, as if that weren't bad enough, just a week ago, I was named the first non-celluloid deep throat in America. I thought I might react to that and other recent affronts. Then I thought about the experience of that great emissary of Realpolitik, Prince Machiavelli, who many years ago, they say, was on his deathbed. His wife got concerned. She called in the local cardinal to render the last rites. He came in and he said, "My son, you are about to meet your maker. Do you confess your sins and renounce the devil?" And the old fellow looked up at him, his lips trembling, and never responded. Thinking he was hard of hearing, he leaned down and yelled again in his ear. He said, "My son, you're about to meet your maker. Do you renounce the devil?" The old fellow looked up at him. He said, "Cardinal, if what you say is true, this is no time to be making enemies." Now, the third reason I'm very pleased to have this opportunity to speak to you briefly today and to take your question is that it is, of course, a very important period in the foreign policy status of our nation. You know, questions have been asked in recent months as to whether or not the United States has a foreign policy. And I've always said clearly, of course we do, as every American president in my living memory, and I've served seven, have always had a foreign policy, and the essence is the same. That is to create an international environment which is essentially hospitable to traditional American values, with great emphasis on the freedom and the dignity of our individual citizens. Now, I will admit to a certain conservative bent to the current regime in Washington, a bent which suggests that the good of the common man is best served by the energy, skill, ingenuity, and work ethic of the uncommon man. And I know this organization encompasses a membership replete with many uncommon men and women. Now, it seems also to me, as an observer of almost 20 years at the national level of security policy and national policy formulation, that our two-party system creates a dialectic of its own, which, if we are not careful of it, will confuse our people, those with whom we share values abroad, and perhaps even more importantly, those who do not share our values abroad. We must always be careful to avoid lurching, if you will, from extreme to extreme in cycles of 4 years. I recall the early 70s, and I was part of the Washington team at that time. We were accused with some credibility to conducting a foreign policy that was preoccupied by self-interest and realpolitik. That was followed by a four-year cycle in the latter part of the decade just passed, in which the compulsion was the achievement of ephemeral values and the discarding of many of the fundamentals of national power in the process, and indeed self-interest on occasion. Now, I have always said that we have got to avoid this mindless lurching, if you will, from extreme to extreme. We've got to recognize that an American foreign policy that sets aside traditional American values in a compulsive quest for self-interest will ultimately offend America's sense of right and lose the essential popular support it must have. On the other hand, a foreign policy dominated by a compulsive quest for international pieties and which sets aside the realities of power and national interest will ultimately offend America's sense of reality. And so we must have a balance and a blend. And I am confident that in the months and days ahead, full recognition will be given to the need to conduct a foreign policy which is essentially bipartisan in character and which blends as the great German philosopher Hegel once suggested, a synthesis of durability and credibility. Now, I'd like to touch briefly upon four areas of vital importance in the months and days ahead as they have been in the past. And the first is the clear recognition that we Americans cannot influence events abroad successfully if we preside over an economic shambles here at home. Patently impossible. You know, I lived in NATO Europe for 5 years as I watched the American dollar decline in value. And the perception at the time among our European partners was that we were intentionally driving the value of the dollar down because we were unable or unwilling to discipline ourselves as the escalation in energy costs continued to rise, and we were seeking to share that burden with them rather unfairly. Today, we're being accused of precisely the opposite, of letting our dollar values rise, our interest rates rise in such a way that we can achieve trade advantage. Now, clearly we know our problems in the economic sphere here at home and abroad are both cyclical and structural in character. And clearly we know, as any manager of a household today knows, that until revenues and expenditures are placed in some greater balance, the consequences will be self-defeating anomalies, whether they be interest rates, inflation rates, declining productivity, or the like. And so we must continue to work that problem. Now, the great tragedy of the months ahead is, of course, that simultaneously our national leadership must not only deal with the rectification of long-standing bipartisan errors in the domestic economy, but they must also correct 2 decades of neglect to our defense capabilities. And how inviting and tempting it's going to be in the months ahead as we look at the horrors of putting some fiscal responsibility in our Social Security program, as we look at the horrors of attempting to generate, as we must, maximum levels of employment, and how the temptation will grow to gut the defense budget of the United States of America. Now, that would be a tragedy, in my view. It would undercut the credibility of the United States throughout the world, and the consequences would be increasingly dangerous. You know, it is our defense capability that provides the credibility for effective American diplomacy in this quest for peace. Now, I don't doubt that there are some inefficiencies, especially with the precipitous decline in inflation that can be achieved in the months ahead. But if we look to this defense receptacle as the sole contributor to greater fiscal responsibility, we will be making a profound mistake. Now, I say it not only because of the credibility it provides to our leadership and the maintenance of peace, but because it is also the essential incentive for meaningful, real, and substantial armed control. You know, I remember in NATO Europe, as the Soviets began to deploy the SS-20, threatening all of the capitals of Western Europe and at the rate of 2 a week. At that time, we urgently requested immediate arms control discussions. Those discussions were never agreed to. The answer was yet, 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 until such time as President Carter and the European leaders decided to modernize our own theater nuclear arsenals, and within a matter of weeks, there was agreement in principle to conduct theater arms control talks, which are now underway in Geneva. Now, the second area of fundamental importance in the weeks and months ahead is the refurbishing, the strengthening, and the reinvigorating, if you will, our traditional friendships, whether in the NATO alliance, in the Atlantic community, or in this hemisphere, with those who share common values. Now, this is not going to be an easy task. You know, I knew as early as 78 that the period ahead was going to be extremely difficult. And I knew that for 3 reasons. The first was the emergence in Europe of what I call nuclear schizophrenia. You know, time was when our European friends were paranoid at the prospect that the United States may not be willing to trade Washington for Hamburg. But as the balances between ourselves and the Soviet Union began to fall into disarray, that paranoia became a raging concern. On top of that, the decision to modernize our theater nuclear forces in Europe has created a new paranoia. And that is that, indeed, an American president would be willing to go the limit, even nuclear weapons, but he's going to confine the conduct of that battle to European soil. And these two paranoias have converged today to create a schizophrenia that has brought hundreds of thousands of white-faced painted citizens of Western Europe to the streets. Now, we do not have the luxury of condemning those who are concerned about the growth of nuclear weaponry today. They've spawned such things as freeze proposals, requests for unilateral restraint, and less than sound strategic policies. These people are concerned, and genuinely so, and honest people can fall down on either side of that issue. But I, for one, am convinced that we Americans must assure the new leadership in Moscow that, indeed, we do want substantial reductions, but in the absence of concessions and a meeting of the issue halfway, we Americans are prepared to do what we must, or we will put in jeopardy the very peace that those who espouse these new theories cherish as well. Now, the second reason I knew the problems would be difficult were essentially economic. It took no special grain of wisdom to recognize that the world at large is experiencing a downturn in the economic cycle, which has been unprecedented in character. Unprecedented because this time we are all experiencing it together. That has deepened the trough and prolonged its duration. It means that one of us on an upturn cyclically cannot move in and bail out one on a downturn, as we have done with Britain repeatedly since the Second War, as West Germany has done for Italy repeatedly since the Second War. This time we're all in the same boat. And that has deprived us of the flexibility we need. And it's generated a new phenomenon, or the resumption of an old one, that we saw so clearly in the 30s as the clouds of war began to form on the international horizon. And that's what I call economic nationalism, protectionism. How critical it is for us to recognize that since the days of Bretton Woods, the luxury of indulging in economic protectionism has been deprived us all. It not only does not solve the problem, but it complicates the problem. And in the coming GATT meeting this month, it is absolutely essential that prudent world leadership at the top level, not with the experts, but at the political level, fight with all the vigor they can muster to prevent what Helmut Schmidt has referred to as beggar thy neighbor policies, which are beginning to spawn on both sides of the Atlantic and in the Pacific Basin as well. Now, the third reason why it was clear to me these were going to be stormy days is because the Soviet Union has always recognized as one of their principal objectives the splitting up of the unity and the commonality of purpose of the Atlantic community of nations. And every policy they pursue today, from arms control to political blandishments to our Western European partners, is predicated upon that objective. And vitally important in the period ahead, we not lose sight of it. And such proposals that are beginning to emerge in the American Congress to withdraw our forces from Western Europe, can you imagine the impact that such a step would have in the face of the nuclear schizophrenia I just described? Absolutely devastating. And I, in conclusion, would suggest that Winston Churchill some years ago captured it quite vividly when he said, the only thing worse than going to war with allies is going to war without them. And how important it is we remember that. The third area I want to touch upon very briefly is the urgent need in the period ahead to develop a just and responsible relationship with the developing world. You know, we Americans were turned off some years ago by the faddish leftist drift of so many of the developing world leaders, and especially in Africa. Indeed, they did. They did it for a self-serving purpose. They saw in Marxist-Leninism a locomotive through which they could shed the vestiges of colonial world and seize political power, and how effective it was for them as such a tool. But you know, in the intervening years, as the burdens of leadership and the responsibilities these new faddish leftist leaders acquire weighed heavily on their shoulders, They learned that while Marxist-Leninism is a locomotive for achieving power, it is not an engine for economic development. And today their regimes are staggering under the wake of economic deprivation, runaway inflation, non-productivity, hunger, and in some tragic cases, even starvation. So these leaders are reaching out tentatively, finding it difficult to shed the jargon of the left, but still seeking a relationship with the Western industrialized world, which provides the only vehicle for economic development in the modern age. And if we in the West turn a deaf ear, we are not only going to commit a human crime of horrendous proportions, but we are going to soon find ourselves replacing these now increasingly sagacious, though rather leftish, leaders of the developing world with a new wave of revolutionaries, with the sergeants and the junior members of the palace guard who suddenly are re-revolutionized, who seize Marxist-Leninism once again with all of its evils, and we will not have achieved a single thing. Now, lastly and most importantly, I want to say a word about the most essential aspect of the challenge ahead, and that's the relationship between East and West. You know, it was clear that whoever occupied the Oval Office in this decade of the 80s was faced with the reversal of a profound set of dangers, which started with the entry into Angola in 1975 and carried through Ethiopia, southern Yemen, northern Yemen, Afghanistan, Kampuchea, the resumption once again of Cuban-sponsored, Soviet-supplied interventionism in the Central American region starting in 78, that we would have to modify our policies in such a way that the Soviet leadership would be convinced that a new era of moderation and reciprocity had come upon the world. Now, there are those who would suggest that this is an impossible task, this generation of moderation in Moscow. I dispute that. You know, I go to bed each night thanking God I don't live in the Kremlin. These new leaders will preside over a systematic failure of profound historic proportion. We've watched every year for the last five, their failure to meet even minimum economic growth objectives. The public sector in the Soviet Union has been deprived repeatedly as the compulsive projection of national resources continues to go to the defense sector. We are watching the culmination of historic failures in the agricultural sector, where despite the fact they've driven larger and larger segments of their population into agriculture, they are unable simply to feed their people. This is a regime which is presiding over growing and serious centrifugal pressures, not only of the kind we witness in Eastern Europe, Hungary, Czechoslovakia, and most critically in Poland today, but within the socialist republics themselves, as we see the Russian elites approaching a point that by the turn of the century, they will be a minority in their own empire. Did anyone ever ask themselves why the Soviet leaders, for the first time since the Russian Revolution, employed their forces outside their sphere of influence in Afghanistan? It was this concern about these centrifugal pressures, in my view. They watched the spawning of Islamic fundamentalism in Iran and recognized its potential to sweep across Pakistan into Afghanistan and make a contagion through the southern belly of the Soviet Union into the burgeoning populations of Islamic orientation in the southern Soviet Union. Now, all of this suggests to me the complications of this period of transition, which began not yesterday with the demise of an 18-year incumbent, but rather several years ago, probably as early as 77, 78, when the faceless staff men in the Kremlin began to run the government as their aging leader became less and less able to do so. Now, yesterday, it's clear that the thinking has been rather active, and Mr. Andropov is assume responsibility, at least for the party apparatus and the Central Committee. Shortly, we will see whether or not this is a Brezhnev maturing type leadership in which he will also assume the presidency of the state, or whether or not there will be initially a sharing of responsibility. Now, there are those today, and many experts, who are suggesting this or that as to how to deal with this changing situation, which may be one of danger, as some leaders have suggested, some experts, or one of great opportunity, as others have suggested. And again, I raise the finger of caution, the old dialectic frequently based on political motivations here at home, to avoid the extremes, to recognize that any leader of a revolutionary Soviet state must be driven by certain imperatives. And we cannot, for example, afford the delusions of the early 70s where we thought détente would provide a convenient vehicle for letting our defenses down and saving money here at home. Vitally important. At the same time, we must also, and more importantly, recognize today that we Americans can't claim to be so weak that we are unable to sit down and negotiate with the Soviet Union while we are simultaneously strong enough to conduct brittle, confrontational policies day to day. That makes no sense at all. And I think the period ahead must be one in which we recognize that we ourselves must be prepared to reward and seek moderation on the part of the Soviet leaders. On the other hand, we cannot shrink from condemning and even punishing transgressions towards international peace and illegal interventionisms wherever they occur. Now, I, for one, am very, very confident and very optimistic. That's why I've joined Tom Bell's Hudson Institute. You know, we're looking to the future. And I think we Americans have the reason to be enthusiastic, and most of all, our young people must be tended. What they've been hearing from us for years is that they are going to inherit a world that is running out of food, energy, and even bed space. Look at the report of the Club of Rome some years ago, and even the reports of sponsored by the last administration. You know, no analysis confirms. Well, I think clearly that's the case, although in the extreme, I suppose you could say there's comparability. But a dictatorial or a totalitarian or even an authoritarian regime, and there are shades of difference, clearly doesn't feel the same restraints that a democracy will feel. But, you know, as a somewhat diversion from what your question asked, I found this situation to be the case in recently dealing with the Argentine government, such as it was under the then junta. It wasn't a dictatorship in which one man can decide and strike a deal. It wasn't a democracy in which a consensus could be sought and arrived at. It was rather a pluralistic structure in which any single fellow could veto. And that's always difficult, and so there are even other nuances to the question you asked that are important. But I think even a dictatorial model will sooner or later be faced with restraints from the popular constituency that he has got to serve. He'll either be replaced by another leader who will modify policies, or he'll modify them himself. I hope that was a question you asked.
Mr. Haig, could you give us your appraisal, your evaluation of
Yuri Andropov? Well, I can at best do for you what others have done for me, and that is to tap the assessments of experts. You know, he was the head of the KGB. And as I said to Diane Sawyer this morning, that's not paralleling in any sense the presidency of a girls' school. He was also the ambassador to Hungary in 1956 at the time of the suppression of the Hungarian people. Oddly enough, Hungarians to whom I have spoken about the individual, and he stayed there for some time after the suppression, view him as somewhat more moderate than other Soviet alternatives. He sent his children to Hungarian schools and at least appeared to them to be an advocate for some lessening of the initial repression. He is, as a result of his recent experience presiding over the KGB, he's become sort of the foreign affairs guru for the faceless staff I spoke about. And clearly he enters office as the chairman of the Central Committee as an individual experienced in international affairs, oriented towards those affairs, a self-assured and very competent Soviet official. I hope I've answered your question. Yeah.
Could you kindly comment on the situation in the Middle East and what you're seeing down the road?
Yes, and contrary to a recent newspaper report in this town, which will remain unnamed, I want to state at the outset that I support the president's recent initiatives designed to achieve peace in the Middle East and carry that peace process forward. But I would suggest that sometimes it's very difficult for Americans to sort out the forest from the trees. We tend to get caught up in day-to-day events, such as the crisis in Lebanon, and to view the situation as a snapshot in time. There are four interrelated problems that must be dealt with simultaneously, and progress in one or movement in one cannot proceed without a careful assessment on its impact on the other. I'm talking about the superpower competition in the Middle East. I'm talking about the dynamics within the Arab world. You know, as I spoke to Arab leaders in recent months, their concerns were not the frustrations associated with a lack of progress in the peace process. Their concerns were the same as those that I described in Moscow, and that is the emergence of Islamic fundamentalism and the fear that it would sweep from Iran into Iraq, where the tensions and the conflict continue today, through the Gulf states, endangering each and every one of their incumbencies, through Saudi Arabia and perhaps beyond to the northern tier of Africa, where the monarchies and the dictatorships of the Islamic world exist today. Now, no one can be expected to take objective risks for peace in one sector if he's terrified about his security in the next. I think that's important. Finally, there's the question of Lebanon itself. You know, we've been very quick to point our finger at the state of Israel. And indeed, in some respects, I suppose, some criticism is justified day to day. But our memories are very short if we forget that we in the Western world, especially France, created this juxtaposition of tightly balanced sectoral and religious Western creation called Lebanon. Even before 1975, it was in delicate balance, which frequently collapsed with great bloodshed and terrorism within that society. Then in 1975, when the PLO was driven out of Jordan and went into Lebanon, we Westerners became concerned that the PLO would take over Lebanon. So we welcomed Arab intervention, the remnants of which are the substantial Syrian forces that remain in Lebanon today. And I would say that the first order of business in the peace process itself is insisting that all foreign forces get out of Lebanon. I mean Syrian, I mean the remainder of the PLO, some 10,000, as well as the Israeli forces, who I have no reason to believe want to stay in the first place. Now, then we turn to the peace process. And again, memories are very short. You know, when we came in January of 1981, the Camp David Accords, the peace process, were totally stalled. There was little prospect that the Sinai would be returned this past spring as it was on schedule, with totally divergent views between Egypt on the one hand and Israel on the other. In the intervening months, we bridged those gaps, and indeed, the Sinai was returned on schedule. And at no little cost, political or otherwise, to Israel, as well as to Egypt. It was a difficult process. Now, let's talk finally about the spirit of Camp David. You know, Camp David was a translation further of 242, where there were certain ambiguities in the UN resolution, intentionally written into the UN resolution. Those same ambiguities carried themselves into the spirit of Camp David, and the signatories agreed that they would set aside the millennium, in other words, their own long-term objectives. That was true of Sadat, it was true of Begin. And instead adopt a procedural arrangement in which transitionary steps would be set in place, confidence would be built, and an evolutionary, hopeful, peaceful solution and just solution would result. Now, if we set that aside in our efforts in the weeks and months ahead, we are going to put too great a strain on the art of the possible. And so I believe that I can say and repeat, I support the President's efforts, which are courageous. I caution that they must be done not with the millennium as the objective, but with a real achievable set of progressive steps, the first of which must be to clean up the mess in Lebanon. Thank you. I'll take one final question if you have it, and it's short. I'm sorry, I missed it because you... Well, I want to make it very clear that I do not believe personalities per se are going to be the litmus test upon which future American-Soviet relations will hinge. We Americans have a great tendency to view our counterparts abroad as mirror images of our great democratic selves. Nothing could be more self-defeating. Well, I would hope so, and I'm very pleased that the President said yesterday in his press conference that he seeks the improvement in relationships with the Soviet Union. But let us recall, with Soviet forces today marauding Afghanistan, indirect repression continuing, although we had a very fortuitous event reported this morning, if it turns to be true, and that is that Valeska was released, I would say some signal is important. In the meantime, we Americans must continue to try. You know, we can't ask the American people to bear the burdens of the defense lecture I gave here today if we're not perceived to be trying to improve the situation. We must try, even when we were rebuffed. But we've got to do it with clear-headedness, with an understanding of the nature of the problem, and it's not a personality problem. Never was. Systematic problem. Thank you very much for your attention. It's been a great honor to be with you.